Case number 21-1548, Joseph Meadows versus City of Walker, Michigan, et al. Oral argument, 15 minutes per side. Mr. Garish for the appellants.
You may proceed, Mr. Garish.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Jeffrey Garish on behalf of the dependent appellant officers. This is our appeal from denial of summary judgment. Oh, I should say, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. It looks like the clock has reflected that. If I cut into some of my rebuttal time answering questions, I'm happy to do that. I want to answer the court's questions. It's a denial of summary judgment based on qualified immunity. The issue essentially is whether it was clearly established in the law on August 29, 2017, whether force of the type used by the officers was excessive under the circumstances as they perceive them. So there are three issues: the nature of the force used, the circumstances the officers faced, and the state of the law at the time. Now, the nature of the force used, there's no dispute about that because the incident was captured on video. I hope and trust that the court has seen the video. I'm not gonna spend a lot of time talking about that because I know the court will draw its own conclusions, but essentially what happened was the officers did pull Mr. Meadows out of his vehicle, and they did force him to the ground, and they manipulated his body onto his stomach so they could handcuff him behind his back, and they did fracture his wrist in doing so. Now, the circumstances that they faced also are all captured on video, so there's no dispute about that either. And those consisted of, first of all, Mr. Meadows blowing by a cop car doing 90 miles an hour when he had his left turn signal on and was going to the right, number one. And number two, he didn't pull over right away. In fact, he didn't pull over until more than a mile and a third after they initiated their signals. In fact, the plaintiff concedes in his brief that it was a full minute and a half from the time they instituted their siren to when he pulled over. The trial court really seemed to dismiss that, but that's a pretty significant circumstance if you think about it. I mean, I've been pulled over a few times. I can't imagine driving for over a minute before pulling over, going more than a mile.
How does that affect the analysis as to whether he should be beaten up after he is taken from the car? I mean, how, you know, his slowness in stopping doesn't seem to be related to that.
Well, it's part of the circumstances that the officers perceived, Judge Rogers, when they did approach the vehicle. And that warranted, I would submit, them proceeding with caution because they have a guy who was just driving recklessly and didn't pull over right away. So then, of course, that moves into the circumstances of the arrest. And that is, he disobeyed several commands. He disobeyed repeated commands to get out of the vehicle. He then disobeyed the command not to pull his hand back into the vehicle. He said he was doing it because the vehicle was locked, but he had just told the officer that it was unlocked. And so it's important to keep in mind the perspective is what the officers perceived at the time. And then he, after he opened the door, he still disobeyed the command to get out of the vehicle. And then even once they got him onto the ground, under the officer's perception, they thought that he was continuing to resist by not turning over to his stomach. And so the question really focuses to our mind on what's the state of the law at this time.
Do you think the video, do you think there are any, I assume the answer is no, but do you think there are any fact questions on whether he could have manipulated his arm, whether it was pinned beneath him, whether he was trying to roll over or not? Are those historical fact questions? Are there disputed historical fact questions on that? Or does the video just show everything and we can make our own conclusions?
I think the latter, Judge Nalbandian. I will concede that it's a little bit hard to see on the video whether he's pulling away with his wrist as they're trying to cuff him. And I understand that I have to take the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. He says that he's not trying to pull away and he couldn't turn over onto his stomach. But the officers, even if you look at the video, the officers reasonably perceived that he wasn't turning over onto his stomach. And of course, that was after he had already disobeyed several commands. And if you look at the case law, what case law says, Rudlaff says that active resistance consists of disobeying officer's commands. So there is active resistance. And then the question is, what does the case law say?
Could I ask an interim question while you're going through that? Does your case depend on what you're about to say, that there was active resistance?
Not necessarily, Judge Rogers, because I think
how do you win if there was no active resistance?
Well, I guess I would say there's a difference. I'm not sure what the difference is between active and passive resistance.
I'm just asking you to hypothesize so we can do our analysis along the same track. Is it essential to your winning this appeal that there was active resistance?
It is, and
disobeying questions.
I think disobeying the questions constitutes active resistance under Rudlaff.
Not my question.
Right.
The question is, what if we don't have that? What if a jury could find the contrary? It's a hypothetical question. You know, they pay us to ask these hypothetical questions.
A
jury could find that there was compliance, that there was apparent compliance at all times. Then you lose the appeal. Is that right?
I think that's right. Okay, I think that's right. You. If there was compliance.
Well, then I guess my next question is, why couldn't the jury find that? I mean, I've looked at that video. It seems like that's what the district judge came to that conclusion as well, is that he was complying at all times, and it was just difficult because the door was, I forget the exact sequence, but you know, he was told to keep his hands out, then he's told to open the door. A logical person would put your hand in to open the door. And at least that's what the district judge seemed to think.
Well, he was told to get out of the vehicle before he was even told to put his hands out, and he didn't do it. And then he was told not to pull his hands into the vehicle, and he did after he had told the officer that the vehicle was unlocked. So under the officer's perception, he has disobeyed the orders. And that's what matters. This court has repeatedly.
Can I ask a question about, I'm curious about this jury versus judge issue. It's not necessarily an issue in the case, but I'm curious about it. Whether someone is actively resisting arrest or trying to evade, let's say one of the Graham factors, is that a question for the jury, or is that if we have all the historical facts, isn't that a legal question? Isn't that what Scott B. Harris told us? These are pure questions of law at this point.
Yes, I think they are, Your Honor. As Scott B. Harris says, and Rudlaff and Cunningham and many other cases, that the court is to take the facts in the light depicted by the video. And the video depicts what happened almost without exception, and that has to do with, you know, once he's on the ground, but it depicts him disobeying the commands of the officer. And the trial court here didn't focus at all on the nature of the case law. And I would submit that there isn't any case that clearly held that what the officers did here constituted excessive force under these circumstances. And to the contrary, Stanfield held that officers were entitled to qualified immunity under facts that are materially indistinguishable by our measure. I mean, in Stanfield, it was the exact same situation. The plaintiff had gotten out of an RV. He was complying. The court even said he was not threatening or hostile, either physically or verbally, but the officers perceived that he wasn't complying because of the way he moved his arms and because he had put his hand in his pocket after he'd been told not to. That is essentially exactly what we have in this case. And in Stanfield, the court held that the officers were entitled to qualified immunity. And that's the case here. Our trial judge didn't analyze.
Stanfield's an interesting case because it holds that there's qualified immunity because the law is not clearly established, but it does say that what the officers did was unconstitutional, right? I mean, it said it was excessive force. So if the facts are similar to this case, there are other issues with Stanfield. It's unpublished when it came after this case, the events in this case, but I mean, it would, our court said that was excessive force, right?
That there was a question of fact about it, yes.
No. We said there was excessive force. Well, okay, maybe. But I mean, I'm just saying that I thought I read the court's opinion as being pretty clear. This was excessive force when they brought this guy down, when they, you know, tried to cuff him. I mean, that would be problematic for you, right?
No, because the court said that they were entitled to qualified immunity, and that was the state of the law at the time this happened. Because Stanfield wasn't issued until March of 2018. Right. This happened in August of 2017. Yeah, so no, the state of the law was the same then.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
All right. Your time's up. You'll have your rebuttal. All right, Mr. Cabot.
Yes, good morning, Your Honor. Sean Cabot, appearing on behalf of the appellee, Joseph Meadows. And I know the panel's read the briefings and the lower court record, and I'm going to do my best not to belabor the facts this morning. But I think there's, you know, while appellant and I may disagree with the law and the application of a lot of the facts, I think there are a few things that are very clear. One thing is that the material facts were captured on video. And I know one of the things that was questioned earlier was that there are some things that a jury, even with the video, are going to have to make reasonable inferences, and they're going to have to look at question of facts, such as, you know, whether to believe the claim of the officers that somehow Mr. Meadows was resisting. Mr. Meadows testified he wasn't resisting. Whether or not, if in fact it was what Mr. Meadows says was the case, was that you have at a minimum two officers who are about 6 foot tall, each weighing approximately 240 pounds that were on him such that he couldn't release his hands. And in the video, you do hear him say, I'm trying, I can't.
I want to draw a distinction between a question of historical fact and the question, what I think is a conclusion, a legal conclusion about whether someone's actively resisting arrest. Is there a question of historical fact in this case? In other words, the video, does the video tell us whether he was trying to move his arm or whether he was pinned down and couldn't do it? Or is that something where we look at the video and then a jury would have to look at, would have to hear testimony from the officers who say he wasn't doing anything, he was resisting, he was thrashing around, whatever they want to say, and he testifies that he was trying to move his arm to comply and get cuffed, and they would have to resolve that question despite the fact that it's on video. Do we actually have historical fact questions or not?
I think there are historical fact questions. Because there are, you know, some aspects that maybe of the video that you can see but aren't entirely 100% clear. There are some aspects of the video where you have to make the reasonable inferences, which means taking what's happened from the very start of this, hearing what he's saying, watching what's going on, that a jury can assess what they're seeing, what they're hearing, and then combining that with the testimony and make the logical and reasonable inferences that he was in fact not resisting. And that's why, you know, the video becomes very important. And one of the things I wanted to note was, I think Brother Counsel said that the first thing that Officer Dumont said to Mr. Meadows was to get out of the truck. I don't believe that's accurate. I recall of the video is that essentially he makes the recording to dispatch that he was making the stop. He was getting off at the Walker exit. And then the first command I recall him making, and I think the video will confirm that, is turn off your truck, put your hands out the window. The first command was not get out of the truck. The first command was turn off the truck, put your hands out of the window. The truck turns off and we immediately see in the video both hands going out the window. And I think, you know, we have immediately compliance. And I know we talked, Brother Counsel talked a little bit about the minute and 4 seconds. And I think Judge Rogers, you know, kind of was wondering, well, you know, So what, essentially? And that's, I think, important, because a couple things opposing counsel has argued, and appellants has argued, well, he was driving recklessly. There's nothing in the video, in my opinion, and I think a jury could reach the same conclusion, there's nothing that lends Mr. Meadows to driving recklessly. We don't see him swerving in and out of lanes.
Isn't there technically, I mean, isn't once you're a certain number of miles of over the speed limit, isn't that reckless? I mean, wasn't he going 90? I mean, it seems like, yeah, he's not swerving around, but what was the speed limit on this road? I mean,
it's I-96, and I don't know that the record established what it was, but I know from traveling that, Your Honor, it was somewhere between 65 and 75.
Okay.
Depending on the time of year, I know it changed.
Okay, so maybe not. He's not going 50 miles over the speed limit.
Right. And
let me ask you this question, though. Why isn't the failure to immediately pull over, why doesn't that go to kind of this trying to evade part of Graham, part of the active resistance or trying to evade? I mean, why wouldn't a reasonable officer be suspicious if somebody doesn't pull over right away?
Well, I think he explains that immediately. I believe soon after he stopped, he talks about he wanted to stop at a safe place. And I believe in our brief, we cited in a footnote the Michigan State Police saying, pull over at a safe place. Here you're on an interstate, it's I-96. Which I guess I probably shouldn't admit this on the record, but there are times I've gone 90 miles an hour at that same stretch of highway. But it is an interstate, and it's a main thoroughfare through that part of the state. And so, I think reasonably pulling off on an exit, especially we hear constantly on the news of people getting hit on the side of the road, Michigan Department of Transportation, help cars getting hit. So, and he says that pretty much right away, I was pulling off so that everybody would be safe. And the officer knew that right away before any force is used. So I think that does factor into the Graham factors, and it helps support the position of the appellee in this case that, look, he wasn't trying to evade. There's no indication in a lower court record that once the lights were activated or even once he passed Officer Dumond, that he increased his speed. In fact, I think from the video, you can see that the speed is decreased. There certainly wasn't any attempt to elude or evade, and he wasn't charged with evasion. He wasn't charged with eluding. Going back, Judge Nalbandi, into your question of recklessness, it doesn't even meet the statute of recklessness, and presumably that's why he wasn't even ticketed or charged with that. And so I think what he did, any jury, I mean, I've unfortunately done it too. If I know there's an exit ahead, and if you look at the video, you see signs for an exit ahead. I've logically waited for that exit, not only for my safety, but the safety of the officers. And I think, especially when you see the initial compliance and continuing compliance by Mr. Meadows throughout this incident, a jury is going to say, yeah, he wasn't evading. He wasn't eluding. He was doing what he said.
What do we do, or what is your answer on the Stanfield case? I mean, it does seem to me to be the closest case that you would have in terms of clearly established law, were it not for the fact that it was, well, it's unpublished, and it says that it wasn't, so it can't clearly establish the law, and it took place after the events here. Doesn't that cut against you? If we said that it wasn't clearly established in Stanfield, why would it be clearly established here?
Well, because I think, I would argue that Stanfield isn't necessarily the most analogous. We cited a number of cases, Lawler versus City of Taylor, and I know, it may be argued, well, that's a booking case. I think that's a distinction without a difference, because the Lawler versus City of Taylor case, which was unpublished, but it was a 2008 decision, dealt with a tackle It dealt with the fact that the tackle came as a result of the plaintiff raising his arm slightly. It also involved multiple times of being struck and hit. And in that case, the Sixth Circuit affirmed Phelps v. Coy, which was decided in 2002, that says, look, when somebody doesn't pose a threat to officer safety, doesn't pose a threat of harm to themselves, any force that's used is constitutionally unreasonable. And so I think that's what you have here. You have from the very moment a situation where, and again, when you watch the video, he is not taken out of that video. He is not taken out of his truck. You can see where his feet barely even touch the ground. When he told to come out and he does, Mr. Meadows' feet barely touch the ground when Officer Dumont then grabs him and throws him on the ground. There's no command in a typical stop of put your hands on the hood, I'm gonna pat you down, any of that. There's no command at all to follow other than him grabbing him and throwing him on the ground. And so according to the law in place at the time, as far back at minimally 2002, when you use force on someone, when there's no use for the need of force, that is excessive per se. And so that was long ago established. And then of course we have the Norton versus Still case that was decided in 2013. I believe Judge Rogers, you were on that panel. It dealt with a booking case, but again, a distinction without a difference, a difference without a distinction, sorry, about a woman who was, you know, allegedly disobeyed some commands of not using a tissue and not getting something to drink. And the officer pulls her arm behind her back, the scooter hits the wall. And again, they said, look, at that time, it was clearly established that that type of force was unreasonable. And then you get into cases of McCaig versus Raber, which is a 2013 case, and Pershall versus Cook, which is a 2011 case. Again, those are all dealing with leg sweeps. They're dealing with throwing them to the ground and the unreasonableness of that. And so our position is you clearly have case law that sets in motion when you have somebody who's not actively resisting. And I think a jury, I think number one, the video clearly shows he was not actively resisting. And when you're not actively resisting, this type of force was clearly violative of the Fourth Amendment. And whether you take the video itself or whether you take the video along with testimony, that can be the logical and reasonable conclusion of a reasonable jury. And so, you know, I guess I disagree to the extent that, you know, Stanfield set some new law into place that wasn't established at the time, because it doesn't. It's really establishing precedent that's been there all the time. In fact, Stanfield, I would argue, is factually.
What I would say, I mean, that seems a little bit odd. And I don't want to belabor it too much, but it is odd that we said and we granted qualified immunity in Stanfield because we said it wasn't clearly established. And I mean, yes, I understand this kind of high at some level of generality, you can't use force against, you know, someone who isn't resisting, let's say, or whatever it is. But the Graham factors, it's the totality of the circumstances test. The three kind of main factors are not exhaustive. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, what do we do about the hands kind of in and out of the vehicle? I mean, why isn't that kind of a threat, a possible threat to the officers? I understand there was some confusion, I suppose, maybe about whether the door was locked or whatever, but from the officer's perception, you know, he's reaching back in, he could have a weapon. I mean, I'm not sure. You know, how does that factor weigh in?
Well, I think, again, that those are factors that have to be resolved by the jury, because he is following commands. You know, whether or not, I don't think there's a question he's following commands. I think the question becomes whether we think he did them in a logical sequence. I mean, we know he's told to put his hands out of the window. I think that's one of the very first commands, and he does that. And then he's told to unlock his door. Now, nobody can put ourselves in the shoes of Mr. Meadows, but I can tell you, if I'm told to put my hands out a window, and then I'm told to open the door, logically, I'm going to pull one hand in. And I think it's critical. He doesn't pull both hands in. He leaves one hand out and he puts one hand in to unlock that door. I think that's logical based upon what's being asked. I wouldn't think, and I've been doing these types of cases for almost 20 years. I don't think at that moment I would try to unlock it from the outside, which he eventually does, and he can't do it because he had hit the lock button where he had his arms on the door. So I think those logical inferences certainly could be made by a jury. And I see my time is up, but I would rely on our briefings, Your Honor, and affirm the decision of the district court.
Okay. Mr. Gerrish.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just three quick points, and I'll, of course, answer any questions that the court has. First of all, it's simply not true that Mr. Meadows wasn't actively resisting. And it's important to keep in mind here that the court has to view it from the perspective of the officers. That's what matters here. What did the officers reasonably perceive? He absolutely disobeyed instructions to get out of the truck. He disobeyed instructions not to pull his hand back into the vehicle. Now, with that in specifically, you know, it's easy to look at it after the fact with 20/20 hindsight and say, well, there was a good reason why he did that. But when you're an officer on the scene and you've told him not to pull his hand in, he's already told you the door is unlocked, and then he pulls his hand in, the officer has to be concerned that he might have a weapon. That's what the officers are faced with. And then even once they got him out onto the ground, and this goes to Judge Nalbandian, and the first question you asked my friend, there is no factual dispute that he was resisting in the perceptions of the officers at the time. They both testified that even when he got on the ground, he was continuing to resist. And even if you look in the video, they told him, turn over onto your stomach, and he wouldn't do it. And he says, I couldn't do it because of the way they had their weight on me. Well, that is exactly what happened in Stanfield. It's exactly what happened in Stanfield. Stanfield, they tried to manipulate him so they could cuff him, and he said he couldn't move the way they were trying to do it. But under their perception, he was resisting, and this court held that they were entitled to qualified immunity because the law wasn't clearly established. And there's no question of fact about it, given the officer's testimony, which I cited on page 8 of my brief. Now, what Rudlaff has said in terms of the case law is that clearly established means, and I'm quoting, existing case law must clearly and specifically hold that what the officers did under the circumstances the officers did it violated the Constitution. There simply was no case law, is no case law in effect, certainly prior to Stanfield, that would clearly establish this at the time. The two cases my friend cited, Lawler and Norton, are completely different precisely because they're in a booking room. And I think the facts in both of those cases were much more egregious in terms of what the officers did. They basically beat the people up. But the fact that it's in a booking room makes all the difference. And Mr. Cabot says that's a distinction without a difference, but that's just not true. I mean, that's a huge difference. When you have an arrestee in the police office and you know he's not armed, that makes all the difference. And this court in Stanfield said so. It specifically distinguished Lawler and perhaps even Norton on the grounds that when it's in a booking room, that's different than when officers are out on a street and they have to deal with someone they don't know if he's armed, they don't know what he's doing, and if he disobeys commands and then also resists being, I'm sorry, Judge Rodgers, you're on mute. Are you trying to ask a question?
Trying to keep you from having to hear all the traffic outside.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I thank you for reminding me. But you do agree, and I think you already did agree, that if the facts which would amount to active resistance under the law, if those facts could be found against you on the by a reasonable jury, that there's, in other words, there's a genuine issue as to that, then that's then you lose your appeal. You've got to have a jury being able to find, being unable to find facts that situation was not presented to the police officer. Isn't that correct or not?
Well, I need to take issue with the premise of active resistance. I'm not aware of any case law that says even if there was passive resistance, it was clearly established that there is a violation of rights. But subject to that,
on the facts of this case, the jury, if the jury finds that the police could not have concluded that he was, I don't know how you saw it, active or passive, that he was resisting by refusing to comply and by not being moved where they were trying to move him. If the jury could conclude that those facts were perceived by the police officer, then you don't have to get into any of the rest of it, because you've agreed that you can't take these kinds of forcible actions in that situation. Am I wrong about that?
Can I see my time is up. Yeah, I think you're wrong, Judge Rogers, in the sense that this was captured on video and that the video captures active resistance, but because it captures disobedience of the officer's commands.
Well, if the jury could reasonably disagree with your characterization of the video in accord with what Judge Rogers said, then the district judge was correct, right?
No, because the court has to look at the video, look at the facts in the perspective as the video depicts them, number one. And number two, the officers testified that they perceived that he was resisting even when he was on the ground by pulling away. And there's no contrary testimony that's what the officers perceived.
The jury would be free to disbelieve them based on the evidence of the video, correct? I mean, if you don't have to take a witness's, because a witness says something, if other evidence is counter to that, then you don't have to accept the witness's testimony, right?
But there is no other evidence, yes. But
the jury sees on the video would constitute the other evidence, arguably.
But there is...
You just disagree that the jury could interpret the video in that way, right?
I do disagree that the video can be interpreted as not showing disobedience to officers' commands, and that the video could be interpreted as not resisting once he's on the ground, given the officer's test, because there's nothing that you can see in the video, even after he's on the ground, that shows that the officers didn't perceive that he was resisting.
Okay. All right. We thank you both for your argument. And we'll consider the case carefully.